This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers. And swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Bancroft is drawn to Shark Bay on the West Australian coast. It has extensive seagrass beds and harbours some 10,000 dugong. That's 10% of the world's dugong population.
Welcome everybody to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we look at the ecology and physiology of everybody's favourite movie, monsters, creatures, in this case, preteen sex symbols. This week we are looking at the mermaids from 1989's Disney classic, The Little Mermaid.
Should be perfect.
We're going to look at the physiology of these species today. And then look more at their ecology next week. But before we get to that,
something
my name is Sam Perrin.
I'm a PhD candidate
at the, Norwegian University of Science and
Engineering.
And
there. I
did not earn candidates. It's just what we get given over here in Hawaii. At the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, I also run Ecology for the Masses, along with my co-host Adam Karhis, or Karhis, I can't remember what the correct pronunciation is, who is also a PhD student, who is not also a PhD candidate, is merely a PhD student at the University of Arkansas. the difference is only...
We'll get to the other guy.
Yeah, the difference is only 40 grand, don't worry. And yeah, with us, and he's also a fellow runner and writer at the Ecology for the Masses, and our vet mate Dave. Dave, being short for Davet. His name is actually George.
I just realised technically I'm the only one who can actually call myself Dr. Here today.
No, you haven't written a doctorate. Not a real doctorate. Yeah, you haven't written a doctorate. Once you've written a doctorate, you can call yourself a doctorate. But until then, you're a fake one.
Starting to break all the way across the bar.
To be honest, very few people call their vet doctor anyway. I got off the phone with like somebody yesterday after a surgical procedure and he was like, thank you, doctor. And I'm like, oh, that was nice.
You vets do work a hell of a lot harder than I gave you credit for. Although, I tell you what, my med student friends are always just like, you know, they were just tired out and they sort, but they never go on about it. Like, they never go on about it. Vet students never stop crapping on about how much work they do.
Exact opposite here.
Really? Oh, okay, fair enough.
It's all the med students who are just like, oh, my life is so hard.
And to be fair,
real life is very, very hard. They do a lot of stuff, but... The vets do just as much, and in some ways you could say more, because they have to memorize more bodily systems than just one.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And to be fair, vet life is very hard.
Patients can't talk to you.
I mean, look at Dave. Have you ever seen a photo of him? He's actually just 21. Like, it's hit him hard.
Just aged horribly.
Yeah. So, today, like I said, we're looking at Hans Christian Andersen's... Well, not Hans Christian Andersen. I don't think he was around when the film was created. But we're looking at The Mermaids from The Little Mermaid.
It's also a horrible story.
Yeah, have you included that in your history of The Mermaids?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yes. Yeah. Oh, before we get into this, I just want to send a quick shout out to Houston Zoo. Have you guys checked out Valentine, a Species?
No. You're talking about the feeding your ex to the...
Yeah.
No, I did not mean, my girlfriend showed me that this morning, actually, the zoo that will let you pay them $5 to name a cockroach after your ex and feed it to a rat.
Yeah.
Feed it to the meerkats, I think.
Meerkats, yeah.
Which is just great.
No, but Houston Zoo has released a series of tweets online called, it's hashtag Valentine the Species on Twitter. So let's say... Roses are red, turtle eggs in the sun. If it's warm, there'll be daughters. If it's cold, there'll be sons. It's just a really fun example of like public outreach by a zoo.
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Good psy communication. Yeah.
I am never gonna see a merman, ever.
Dude, be thankful. Those things are terrifying. The cleanup on them is a nightmare.
Anyway, so what's going to happen today is that, we're going to give a brief overview of the Little Mermaid, the film, and possibly I think we should go over the horrifying Hans Christian Andersen tale.
I'll do broad strokes.
Yeah, very briefly.
Awesome.
We said last week that we were going to supplement the information with a bit of mermaids from other pop culture, but I don't think we really need to. I think there's enough in the actual initial film for us to go on.
Yeah. Which is based off of a Danish story anyway. Yeah. Or whatever.
Well, so we'll just be talking about the other little mermaid today. We won't get into Ursula because that's way too difficult.
And she was so scary.
She was so scary. Yeah.
I'm not doing Ursula.
But anyway, yeah, so.
She had the best song.
Adam, do you want to take us through the 1989's The Little Mermaid? And then afterwards we'll do some comparisons to the original horrific story.
The original story was written by a Danish author named Hans Christian Andersen.
The most Danish name ever.
Not really, though, because it's spelled C-H-R and it's not K-R. Which is interesting.
Oh, there's
I thought it was KR.
There's enough Christians with the CH in. They are there. They exist.
True. We have a Danish professor at our department named Christian, and it's spelled like that. So what do I know?
Yeah.
Everything, obviously.
Yeah.
So the first tale was published in 1837, and unlike The Little Mermaid, the 1989 film, this was horrifying. So much like in the movie, the Ariel. She's not called Ariel. She's just the Little Mermaid. She is 15, not 16, and a tradition in the Undersea Kingdom when these mermaids come of age, 15, they get to go up to the surface, take a quick glimpse to see the humans, see what everything is like. But Ariel is the youngest of five older sisters, and she's heard her entire life. They're all born 1 year apart because these details matter in Hans Christian Andersen's stories because he's fucking weird. He was. And they're all born 1 year apart, so for 5 years in a row, she's heard her sisters talk about this amazing oversea, you know, the land, the people, the humans, whatever. And the Little Mermaid, she gets her chance. She goes up, and she sees a prince on a boat, and she's like, oh my god, he's so beautiful, wow, this is great. It's a birthday celebration for him. She falls in love, because that's what happens in stories. And in real life, obviously, that's totally real. And like in the movie, a violent storm hits, the ship goes down, the Little Mermaid saves the prince. She delivers him to the shore. Unlike in the movie, she doesn't sing to him. She just kind of waits until somebody finds him, and then she kind of fucks off. The unfortunate thing is that the Little Mermaid isn't seen or acknowledged by the prince, like in the movie, but unlike in the movie, the prince doesn't go looking for her. He's just kind of like, eh, someone saved me. Cool. And she gets really sad, and this is where it kind of gets really weird. It starts going into the strange details of the Hans Christian Andersen story. So she gets sad. She asks her grandmother if humans can live forever. Grandma says, no, the humans don't live as long as our mermaids, 300 years, because there's just so many details. If you want a more thorough explanation of how detail-oriented and crazy the story was, listen to the Myths and Legends podcast. That guy does a really good job of breaking down
how
crazy Hans Christian Andersen was.
Yeah.
But, so humans can live for, you know, our normal time, but mermaids, 300 years on the dot. But then when they die, they turn into seafoam and they cease to exist, because that's what death is. But humans have an eternal soul that lives in heaven. Right?
Wait, do you not turn into seafoam when you die?
I do.
I mean, Canadians turn into chunks of ice and then just kind of like drift off into the north.
I thought it was maple syrup.
I thought that was... depends on the day.
I've been to the home of Hans Christian Andersen, actually, in Odense, which is the only other town in the whole of Denmark that's worth visiting. And they love to tell about, you know, the fact that he lived there and he grew up there. What they don't tell you about is the fact that he fucking hated it and he got out of there as soon as he possibly could. Yeah.
Yep. Have you seen the statue in Copenhagen?
Yeah. It's fine.
It's cool.
Yeah.
It's tiny.
It is. It's tiny.
It's a nice spot.
Yeah. Anyway. Where were we?
So, she wants to be a human. She goes to the sea witch in a dangerous part of the ocean. And the witch is like, yeah, I'll give you this potion. It'll give you legs, but you got to give me your tongue and your voice.
Yeah.
Because this is the point where they kind of mention the Little Mermaid has like the most enchanting voice in the world.
Yeah. And it's not like...
yes, absolutely, I'll do that.
Yeah. It's not like metaphorical, like I'm just going to take your tongue and you won't be able to speak. Like it's physical removal of the tongue.
Yeah. I'm going to take your actual tongue and your voice. And then the witch is like, okay, also, by the way, when you're human, you'll never be able to come back to the sea. You know, this place you grew up where all your family is? She's like, yeah, whatever, cool. I just want to get this prince. He's the best. I love him so much. He doesn't know I exist. Consuming the potion will also make her feel, quote, as if a sword is being passed through her body. Yet when she recovers, she will have two human legs and will be able to dance like no human has ever danced before. Asterisk. That asterisk being... she will constantly feel as if she's walking on sharp knives, and her feet will bleed terribly, non-stop.
Yeah.
In addition, she will only be able to attain a soul if she is able to win the love of the prince and marry him. It's part of his soul will flow into her, because that's what marriage is, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So, if the prince marries somebody else, at the dawn of that first day, the little mermaid will turn into seafoam, and that's it.
Okay.
So, after this agreement, the mermaid does all this, drinks the potion. The prince finds this poor, bleeding, writhing in pain woman on the beach, and he is enchanted by her beauty and her grace, just like Tom Jones said. But, and he likes to see her dance, and she dances, you know, despite how much pain it causes her, non-stop.
Nice.
He becomes her favorite friend. They go on a lot of adventures together. Well, not really adventures, just whatever rich people did back then. So just kind of like walk from place to place and talk about to the poor people and how much better they are than them.
Mm-hmm.
But the prince's parents are like, you should marry the neighboring princess because that's what the royals did. And he does it. And
yeah. Unfortunately, he does.
That's just kind of what happens. And as the prince and princess are celebrating their new marriage, Little Mermaid, her heart breaks. She's like, I sacrificed all this for you. Sure, we can't talk. Like, you, maybe you don't know that I love you, but I made a really poor decision because I'm 15 years old.
Yeah.
And now I know that death is waiting for me. And this is one of the other really weird parts. So she's thinking of the death that is awaiting her. But before dawn, her sisters, all five of them, come out of the water and they bring her a knife. The sea witch has given them in exchange for their hair, which is like, why does this witch need so many body parts? Like, what is she doing with these tongues? His hair, whatever. But the Little Mermaid.
Maybe it's a said, Silence of the Lambs kind of thing going on.
Yeah, yeah, they got Buffalo Bill. So they tell her that if the Little Mermaid kills the prince and lets his blood drip on her feet, she'll become a mermaid once more, and all of her suffering will end. And she'll live out her full life in the ocean with her family, her full 300 years.
Yeah.
But the Little Mermaid's like, I can't kill him, because he's, look at him, he's so cute sleeping next to his new bride. She throws the knife and herself off the ship into the water just as dawn breaks. Her body turns into sea foam, but instead of ceasing to exist like she was told, she feels the sun and discovers she's turned into a luminous and ethereal earthbound spirit. And if I remember correctly from the Myths and Legends guy's summary, there is a lot of like adventures as she's a spirit, and it goes on and on and on in the book. But as she's become a daughter of the air. Mermaid ascends in the atmosphere. She's greeted by the other daughters to tell her that she's become like them because she tried so hard with her heart to obtain an immortal soul. Because of her selflessness, which I don't really think is selflessness, but whatever, she's given the chance to earn her own soul by doing the good deeds to mankind for 300 years and will one day rise up into the kingdom of God.
Yeah.
Because, of course, it has to end on a Christian note.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, the movie is, yeah, much, much more palatable. I don't think what Adam just read out would really make a good kids' film. I think
not in the least, yeah. But speaking of the movie, yeah, it's 1989. It's kind of credited as breathing life back into the Disney movies and kind of yep. And starting the Disney Renaissance, where you have these really pretty hand-drawn characters and all the catchy music.
Yeah, the animation is gorgeous.
Made 200. Yeah, yeah, it is. To date, it has made $211 million, and yeah, it's all despite coming from this horrible, horrible story by Hans Christian Andersen.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that there's, you know, some improvements. I really liked, I think Ursula's a fantastic villain, kind of a cross between the Kraken and,
so good.
Adam's favorite movie villain, Dr. Frankenfurter.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
He does she love is. Oh. Rocky Horror Picture Show. As a side note of something else, just watching the films again and, like, just catching up last night, I was rewatching a little bit of it, and I was realizing the humans back then would smell. Like, the prince would smell horrible. And, like, when Ariel, like, comes
absolutely
up through the water and, like, they're all running around on the ships, like, I imagine that would have been the moment that she was like, I don't know, humanity's not really what I'm after yeah. here.
Just but fucking bilge water stinking up blossom. The sea, people throwing their feces overboard.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like it would not be the right environment that you'd
His
be like, this, I want a part of this. Yep, yep. Yeah. Like...
A mermaid!
This hook hurts!
Oh, now give me my three wishes!
The hell are you talking about? There's a hook in my face!
You mean mermaids don't grant wishes?
That's genies, you ass!
On to what we thought of the film. I don't think this aged that well.
I don't think it's aged terribly.
Watching The Little Mermaid came right around the time of me watching the Batman animated series with Poison Ivy and watching Jessica Rabbit in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which came out a year before The Little Mermaid. But this awoke my love for redheads, so Ariel will always have a special place in my heart.
Fair enough.
I don't think it's aged. terribly. I mean, like, there is a lot of stuff, like, King Trident's behaviors towards his daughter are very questionable. Yes. Ursula still holds up as, like, I thought I was going to rewatch this and they were going to be much more of a sexist tone towards Ursula being the villain, but I thought she was still great.
Dave, do you want to take us through the physiology of the mermaids, or mermen, merpeople?
The merpeople. Merman. Yeah, the merfolk is what the movie starts off by calling them. Yeah, so in terms of the merfolk, I did end up taking a look at movies outside of The Little Mermaid, but as we were sort of discussing in the beginning, I feel like it's best if we just sort of focus our efforts on The Little Mermaid, because there's lots of material there, and there's lots there's of tons. Stuff to work with.
Yeah.
I'm going to touch on a couple of subjects very briefly that we've discussed before, just so I can kind of bring it up. And I'm also just going to sort of like work my way through what I think are the most interesting systems. Sam may cut me off at one point because he's like, Dave, this isn't interesting. I don't want you to focus on this.
I'll just cut it out.
But, yeah.
Yeah, go on, Dave. Tell us more about that. That's fascinating.
The systems that I'd like to focus on for this one. The first one is gills versus lungs. Because I hear this a lot, and we've talked about this sort of briefly in a couple of the other episodes, but we really haven't gotten into like the nitty-gritty of the details, that frequently people are like, oh, well, you know, why don't humans have gills? And like, why don't we have Westworld? Like, Kevin Costner had gills, and he seemed to be doing just fine. The reality of the issue is you can't really have gills as a large organism. And we know that in terms of large, more complex systems, your metabolic rate is just too high. We climbed up on land originally, or at least our ancestors did, the first sort of terrestrial creatures.
Tiktaalik.
And adapted lungs in order to gain more oxygen, because the oxygen, the air that we're breathing, is around 21% O2. That's a lot of material to work with. And we pull about 4-5% out sort of with each breath that we take.
I thought air was like 84% nitrogen.
Yeah. But the air is 21% oxygen, and then the rest is carbon dioxide. It's not 84% nitrogen.
Okay.
I thought it was like in the 70s in terms of its composition. But O2 is around 21%. It's 20.95%.
Okay.
Usually. Cool. But the oxygen that's dissolved in the water, that's the oxygen that fish breathe. It's less than 1%. I mean, it kind of varies across the board. But we get down to areas where it's like 0.02%, depending on where we are. Fish have a complex mechanism for extracting air from the water, as we've discussed before, where basically you run water in what's called a countercurrent exchange over top of blood vessels that are within your gills, and some of the CO2 dissolves out and some of the oxygen dissolves into the blood, and then they use that to sort of buffer in the same way that we breathe in. And when we breathe in, we absorb oxygen into the blood and we diffuse CO2 back out, and then we breathe out. Similar system, but very, very complex, different origins. Now, the problem is that Ariel is just too big. If you want to sort of survive off the oxygen that's in the water, one, you have to not be producing your own heat. You have to be an ectotherm. Most fishes are ectotherms. Second, you can't really be all that complicated. You're not going to be able to have the kind of neural function that Ariel generates. As we've discussed before, your brain takes about 20% of your resting basal metabolic rate. She needs to breathe. So
her baseline stupidity makes sense.
Yeah, we're going to build her much more similar to what we've seen in whales or dolphins. So that allows me to make some really cool adaptations, because whales and dolphins are one of our best organisms for long diving animals. It does mean that Ariel is going to have to surface, or the mermaids are going to have to surface on a pretty regular basis to get oxygen, and then return down to like lower depths, depending on what they're doing. They're most likely not going to have a big hidden undersea city that they live in, unless they're taking these big gulping breaths, coming down, hanging out for 5 minutes, and then heading back up to the surface, which is unlikely.
And we'll touch on this when we look at the habitat next week, because I actually think they're more like intertidal species.
Yeah,
perfect.
Yeah.
But just some big adaptations for how does a whale, a dolphin, hold its breath for so long? Because whales themselves can hold their breath for about 90 minutes, sort of like the longest. Usually they get sort of a range from like 20 minutes to an hour that they aim for.
Sperm whale, baby.
that they attempt to do for sort of going on. So in order to do this, the big changes that they end up having is, first of all, they have way more blood than we do. So they end up having about 3 to 4 times the amount of blood that's found in a normal terrestrial mammal. So humans have about...
Relatively speaking, or just period?
Period. So humans have about 70 milliliters... relatively speaking. But humans have about 70 milliliters of blood per kilogram, as opposed to our dolphins and our whales have about 200 to 250 milliliters of blood per kilogram of body mass. So you just have more of it.
Makes sense.
The second thing that you do is you don't actually store when you're doing these big dives, and we'll talk about this a little bit later. You don't really store air in your lungs. Instead, you store all of your oxygen in your blood, and then basically you use that resource over and over and just keep recirculating it. So they've got huge stores of two compounds, the first of which is hemoglobin. That's the material that makes up the oxygen-carrying unit on our blood. So they have a level that's about 2 times what's found in us in terms of the amount of hemoglobin that they have. So they have more blood, and the blood itself also has more iron in it. And then they also have way more myoglobin. And myoglobin is just kind of a protein that's stored in the muscle. They have about 10 times that that's found in a normal human that they use for storing. So they create these huge O2 resources within their tissues, and then they use those when they're making these big dives. They reduce their heart rate in terms of just so that they're using less energy when they're going on these dives. They have better thermal adaptation, so they don't get cold. They keep body heat. The mermaids are probably going to have to be fat. Again, unfortunately, this episode, the episode is going to turn out a lot like what we did with King Kong. By the end of this, I don't think that anybody is going to want to have sex with a mermaid.
I think these are going to be Cabin in the Woods mermaids by the end of this.
Well, I posit, and like I said, look at the habitat, but I think they're in tropical waters. And fairly, like I said, intertidal zones, not that far down, because the further down you go, the colder it gets. And that little, like I said, if they're going to have that little blubber or fat, they cannot be in deep water and they cannot be in temperate zones. They have to be around the equator.
Yep. So, I mean, if they're in those areas, that's fine. They are going to need more streamlined bodies, because that is how you save energy when you're underwater. You glide a lot to basically not keep swimming.
Like we touched on briefly with the Aquaman episode, having arms and legs in an aquatic environment is incredibly disadvantageous.
It's not a good idea. So if you guys can come up, I'm just saying it's not going to be advantageous for deep dives. The thing is, if they take on each of these adaptations, it will allow them to be under for longer. If they keep more of the features that we see in terms of like the arms or the hair or the other things like that, it's going to create much more problems, and it's going to limit their dive times, and it's going to limit their ability to move easily through the water.
The hair I found no use for whatsoever.
There is no use. There are multiple papers that talk about the fact that, like, watching Aquaman where your hair is like kind of like bumping up and down and all over the place, it's just going to pull. It's going to pull the entire time you're in the water. It's not useful. It's not helpful. It's not going to help maintain body heat. The mermaids would be bald. They would be completely hairless.
Yeah.
You have pressure tolerances. So depending on how deep we want these guys to dive and how long they're going to be under, if they do end up diving deep, they're going to have to take on some qualities to allow them to do this. This is going to have some features that kind of feature into what I want to talk about. Now, we kind of already dealt with this a little bit with Aquaman, so I don't want to spend too much time on this. But the big features that allow you to survive if you go deeper and the pressure increases, which I do think our mermaids are able to dive a certain depth, so they're going to need some of these adaptations. The first of which is you want to minimize air-filled cavities in your body to avoid what humans call the squeeze when we're going down, where the pressure starts to build up and you can feel like your ears popping and other things like that. So one of the features that whales and mammals have is they actually have a big blood vessel inside the middle ear that, as they start to go down in depth, expands and takes up space to basically reinforce that and kind of push the air out of that area to make sure it doesn't collapse. They've got really developed what are called eustachian tubes, which are these tubes that run from your ear to basically the back of your throat that allow them to better sort of normalize or equalize pressure between those areas. And the last thing is that they lack cranial sinuses. So the sinuses that are just kind of located up above your nose, they end up not having those. That's what kind of why whales and dolphins have that distinctive head shape along with hydrodynamics. What I'm trying to say is that the mermaids are going to have a little bit of a weird head, most likely, because there's no purpose to have a cranial sinus. Lung
so
changes.
Bald, weird hump-shaped head. No, like they're fat, and they're kind of.
They're going to be. They're going to be a little bit. They're going to have more body fat. And then the last.
So they look just like Sam.
Hold on.
The last change that I was going to make is their lungs are most likely going to collapse if they dive deep. They're most likely going to collapse when they go underwater. So most species like dolphin and whale, their lungs actually collapse under the water. They've got systems in place that allow this to happen because, as we discussed, they're not carrying their oxygen in their lungs. They're carrying it in their blood. So if we're going to be underwater for a long period of time, most likely our lungs are going to collapse when we're under the water. Yeah, so that was just kind of, I needed to touch on that. Now I get to some of the cool stuff. Skin. Human half. So I had to create two different epidermal zones for these animals because they're going to have a human half and then they're also going to have their fish half. So
it's not a fish half.
It's going to have to be semi-fish half.
It can't be. It can't be. They are not a fish half because the undulation of the tail is vertical. It's not horizontal.
Yeah, exactly. I and I'll talk about this as we go on. However, their scales are shiny, Sam. They're not like a traditional bony fish.
That,
so like,
yeah, but that is a much more, you know, oh, we can just put it down to Disney's
fine.
Disney being
it's,
wrong.
It's
even
not,
even Adam's
right.
horrifying merman in Cabin in the Woods, that had up and down tail undulation. It's always the same.
Yes. Right, yes. So it's technically not going to be a fish half, but it will have fish scales, Sam.
Yeah.
Again,
think more like
I'm
a dugong.
Maybe they're skinny jeans.
Yell at the movie.
Yeah.
They're air party skinny jeans.
So
maybe it's just like, you know, beautification. It's like a tattoo.
I think it's more just drunk sailors who see these things or be like, oh yeah, it was totally a beautiful woman I was sleeping with.
So,
like this weird fish thing. You know, it gets real lonely on a boat.
I didn't just
really
fuck a manatee. Yeah.
And I'm not going to sleep with my shipmate. That would be gay.
Dave, you got something
to
say?
To preface this, what these idiots are talking about is completely right. There is no reason to have two different zones of having like a human half and a fish half, but I'm going to try to explore both of these because we are Cinematica Animalia and we try to make these things work.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing we had to talk about is their skin is going to have different properties from what you or I have. And the best example of this is a human that spends too long in the water, you often get that sort of wrinkled or pruned effect. Now, we used to think for the longest time that this actually had to do with water like perforating into the tissues and causing this almost like waterlogged effect. Skin doesn't work like that. We're pretty water resistant. There's actually been some really new interesting papers that came out that's discussed the fact that we think your skin wrinkles and you end up with those sort of like ridges that form to try and improve our grip when we're in wet or submerged environments. Just a really interesting piece of research, and it actually seems to be a nerve effect. There's a reflex that goes into this. So if nerves are damaged in your hands or in your feet, you don't actually end up taking on this wrinkled or pruned effect that you see on your fingers or your toes. But most likely, the mer people are going to end up building their skin more similar to sort of what we see with like the dolphin. Dolphins have a completely hairless, thick skin. It's about 10 to 20 times thicker than what we see in humans. It doesn't have hair because, again, as we discussed, there's no point. It also doesn't have sweat glands. This extra degree of waterproof nature gives them a little bit of extra heat resistance or heat containment. So that might be how they get around the whole not being fat thing, is their skin is just slightly thicker and allows them to better maintain their heat in the water. The other thing,
Dave.
They're still going to need extra fat. They cannot be like, Ariel's a size zero. You cannot be that skinny in that environment. She's still going to have extra body fat.
Yeah, but like I said, I don't think, if they're an intertidal species that can potentially even spend some time sunning themselves, I don't think they're going to need to be enormous like a manatee or a dugong.
Not enormous, but you are still going to lose heat more readily in the water than you would be on land under certain conditions. You are still going to need adaptations to better maintain your body heat.
I mean, if a human stays underwater, because, hang on, what's, if a human stays underwater at, like, 25 degrees, 25 degrees is pretty warm for water, but if you stay under that for long enough, I mean, it's going to drag your body temperature down, and you can eventually die of hypothermia.
Yeah, so they're going to need changes to avoid that problem. The other super cool thing, which I hadn't realized, dolphin skin is in a constant state of slough. It's constantly being produced in new layers and sloughing off. The reason is that they want to stay as smooth as physically possible to make sure that they move through the water with the least amount of resistance.
Because they're a bunch of perverts.
So the mermaids are going to be very smooth, which will make Adam very happy.
Absolutely not. Dolphins... Speaking of your comments about my favorite movie ever, dolphins are fucking rapists and they're terrible creatures.
Lots of so many marine things, seals, otters, dolphins,
whales.
Just a bunch of sexual predators.
Dolphins are also one of the only other species recorded to murder for fun, just cause.
Have you guys seen that thing about pufferfish on the online this week? There's been documented pufferfish that their poison, their venom doesn't have any effect on the dolphins, but it gets them a little bit high, so they'll pass like pufferfish back and forth.
I've seen that. Or in a similar vein, like jaguars that like seek out rotten fruit and they'll go eat it, so they get real fucked up because they're drunk off this rotten alcohol-producing fruit, and it's like, whoo, fall out of trees.
Yeah, there's a couple of different areas where animals will gather at fermenting fruit to basically consume in large quantities to get a little bit drunk.
We are animals.
Moving on. So the fish hat.
Smooth pervert boys.
Yeah. So in all likelihood, the mermaids would just have this same type of dolphin skin that continued all the way down their body, ending in a tail at the end. However, the movies attempt to give them scales. The scales don't look like what's typically found in other like sharks or that type. It looks like what's found in sort of... So not cartilaginous fish. It looks like scales that are found in bony fish, specifically leptoid scales. Now, this is more of a Sam area, so Sam, feel free to correct me, because obviously I had to do a bunch of reading before this. But the leptoid scales themselves could be built into this type of skin. They take on more of a shine. They actually are made up of a collagen-type fibril that basically originates from the skin. And they grow over time. They mineralize and get slightly larger sort of as the fish goes. So as they grow, we end up with these scales that continue to enhance in size. So we could have some system similar to this. There's no reason why you would. As well, there's a strange thing that goes on with the mermaids where they have this little bit of extra skin in the Little Mermaid movie that sits between their like human body and between the fish body.
Oh yeah, it makes it look like they've got pants on, yeah.
The belt.
I have no idea what the hell that is. It's not hydrodynamic. It would just drag like anything else, and like it looks like it would flap as well. Like I don't know what it. Anyways, that would not be there.
It gets it caught on it.
It looks like a rolled down foreskin.
Jeez, Adam.
It does. You said it flaps around.
So I can maybe make the scales work where for some reason we would end up growing these scales in the lower half, but it doesn't make sense why you would separate your body plane into two different tissues. There's no extra benefits for protection or hydrodynamics or water resistant or anything else. I really could not come up with a feature as to why any animal would have this. Now, this one I'm going to ask for a little bit of Sam's help with this because he clearly wants to yell about this and we can get through this on the physiology section.
Yeah, go on.
Fish do not swim with their tail going ventral and dorsal to their body plan. They swim with it going left to the right. They create a motion back and forth that they basically use in the medial and lateral direction. They contract muscles on one side of the body while relaxing them on the other, and then perform the opposite direction on the other side, which is how they propel themselves through the water. And they do have dorsal and anal fins, or ventral and anal fins, that we used to think for the longest time
anal.
Was... So we used to think these fins were only for sort of helping them to direct or to get through the water and act as stabilizers. However, there's been a whole bunch of new research that suggests that the dorsal and anal fins actually do make a big contribution to the caudal fin wake in terms of helping them move along.
Really?
Yeah, which is kind of cool. I thought that was cool. Yep. However...
Yeah, I thought they were just stabilizers.
The mermaids are very clearly swimming like dolphins. They've got the tail going up and down. So Sam is completely right. They're not going to be fish. It's very strange they would have adapted scales because no other mammal really has picked up this characteristic. Not really. And the other problem, which I'm sure it sounds like you guys have some other ideas, arms are going to suck in this instance because whales, dolphins, other things like that, they use their lower fins for stabilizing purposes as well as contributing. That's how they're able to turn and shift and adjust their motion through the water. In this case, the mermaids are going to have to try to stick their arms to the body and do like almost a little like flappy arm kind of motion to try and help direct which way they go. Otherwise, trying to move through the water with that centralized caudal fin is going to be a pain in the ass to try and like move quickly or to change direction.
They can go in a straight line really well, and that's about it.
Well, even a straight line is going to be really difficult because your arm goes out. Yeah, your arm goes out too much on the one side or the other, and then you're just going to completely spiral out of control. Now, the last couple of quick things that I wanted to sort of deal with, the first of which is going to be vocalizing your singing, because that's Ariel's claim to fame, and it's also the claim to fame within the original books, is being able to sing. Now, we do know that they're air breathers, right? The mermaids are going to have lungs, they're going to come up to the surface, that's how they're able to view humans, that's how they're able to move along the surface. So, whales, really coolly, I hadn't realized, it's actually in the humpback species, it's the males that make those nice, long, beautiful, complex melodies. We think it's a mating behavior, that's why they're making that noise underwater. Now, how they make this noise, they don't actually lose...
For some whales, at least, it definitely is.
Yeah. So, as a quick review, you or I, when we vocalize out of the water, we're actually pushing air past vocal cords. And those vocal cords are located kind of in the throat, and then we use those to make different noises. That's how we generate basically what we're saying, what we're talking, these different noises or different tones. It's a similar system in whales and dolphins, kind of. Dolphins have a much more complex system where they've got a nasal passage and something called phonic lips that they kind of adjust to change how the sound vibrates, that give them... that give them the ability to produce clicks and whistles. Now, in terms of, I think it's better to just use whales for this situation because we know that Ariel is singing underwater. We're producing complex melodies, or the merfolk are. Whales seem to have some ability to actually shift air between sacs and their lungs internally. They can actually move air between chambers so that they don't actually lose air that's available while underwater. And that air seems to be how they're generating the noise. So again, they are collapsing their lungs, but there is residual air left over within sacs and posterior airways. And they seem to actually shift that air between different chambers, and that's what creates the noises that we hear underwater. So I imagine that the merfolk could adapt some sort of similar system. It would probably require a much bigger body plan to give them sort of like that large resonance, like that booming noise that travels.
Yeah.
So again, the mermaids would end up having to be bigger if they wanted to sing underwater. Otherwise, they could just click or make noises like a dolphin.
Have you guys heard of the 52 hertz whale?
Yes. Yeah, I was going to talk about that.
Yeah. So I just found this out today, actually. There's this whale that they've detected a bunch of times that emits calls at frequencies unlike any other whales. And it's just this whale that they know of, this one whale. So they think it's a type of either blue whale or fin whale that's just been born with some sort of genetic defect and has survived to this age. And because, you know, other whales don't recognize it as one of theirs, it's been termed the world's loneliest whale because it just floats around the world and nobody talks to it.
Yeah. Also, speaking on like whale and cetacean or these dolphins communication, the orcas, the different pods around the world, all have their own different way of communicating with each other, kind of like a language, and it's passed down from generation to generation along with their specific hunting tactics, kind of highlighting their overall intelligence and some would say culture.
Culture, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry for all those people out there who thought humans were the only species that had culture. We are definitely not.
We are absolutely not.
I mean, there are lots of creatures that don't have culture. Sam is a perfect example.
The dugong is an elusive animal, thought to have given rise to the legend of the mermaid. Around the world, dugongs have been hunted to near extinction. Bancroft searches the tropical waters for this endangered species, the elusive mermaid.
So, in summary, they're going to be very large, very tough-skinned,
Big chest.
They're gonna have
short, stubby
collapsible
arms.
Lungs. They're gonna have a lot of blood. Yeah. They're gonna have no hair.
Look,
and...
no foreskin belts.
Dave, I think what you've built is actually just a dugong.
I built a manatee, yes, basically.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, that's the physiology of the mermaids. You can tune in next week for us to go over some of the ecology, including, you know, their evolution, a bit of mermaid reproduction, and what sort of habitat we think they'd be using, and their diet. But in the meantime, before we get to that, Dave, do you want to give us your little vet's PSA for the week?
Yeah. So in terms of like my little vet PSA that I wanted to do this week, it's just access to specialists. So this doesn't seem to be as widely known as I would like within the veterinary community. There are specialists for all kinds of different procedures and areas and things like that that are present. So there are veterinary dentists, there are veterinary cardiologists, there are veterinary radiologists. These are people that did an extra 5 years of training on top of what I've done.
Even within what you've done, there was ridiculously precise specialization, even within just your degree, right? I mean, I remember I was at that bloody ceremony. People were getting awarded for specializing in things I'd never even heard of.
Yeah.
Like dugongs.
So, in terms of if you find yourself at a vet and you've got like a weird surgery that you want done, and you know your GP's like, this surgery is going to be very difficult.
If you
want
to fuse with a fish.
There is nothing wrong with one asking, hey, is this something that you could refer me for? Referral specialists do tend to be more expensive, but they are accessible at all points. There's nothing wrong with asking for a referral. It should be offered by your veterinarian as a point if there's a referral specialist within your area that you can easily get to. Sometimes, obviously, it's not going to be feasible if it's like a 3-hour drive for your pet and we just have to make it work where we are. But pretty much any condition, and there's nothing ever wrong with getting a second opinion. Again, sometimes getting the best care, but don't ever feel like you're stuck in that position. Specialists are fantastic. They make the world go round.
All right. Well, look, thanks for tuning in, everyone. Like I said, we'll be back next week with the ecology of the mermaids. But until then, Adam, do you want to finish us off?
Absolutely. You can find Sam and I on Twitter. Sam is at SamParentNTNU. I'm at Hassock Adam. The podcast is at C_Animalia. You can find us online with our website, cinematicaanimalia.com. If you have questions, comments, concerns, recommendations for future movie monsters or even TV monsters, hit us up at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. And then if you want more of the hard science, but still in an easy-to-digest format, check out ecologyforthemasses.com. And remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Okay, bye, guys. See you next week.
Bye, guys.